It's 2 o'clock, and where we convene from a closed session. Mr. Robinson, if you could introduce the next item.
So I believe we were going to go to public forum right now.
So at this time, do we have any speaker card? I don't see any. So we can proceed with the next item. So, can you get it? Yeah, we're going to have Steve, our board liaison, and that usually it'll take probably 40 minutes.
40, 45 minutes.
Oh, do you want Steve name?
Yes. If we can find him. I think we should move on, and since Steve is going to be with us for the rest of the day.
Yeah.
All right.
So we move on.
Decision made.
Window closed.
Window closed. We open the other window.
Okay, we're moving on to item 9, which is the City of Santa Barbara's presentation on subsurface intake technologies and potable reuse feasibility studies. In 2015, the Central Coast Water Board amended the City of Santa Barbara's NPDES permit to incorporate operation of the city's desalination plant. This updated permit required the city to use screens on the open ocean intake system to reduce impingement and entrainment. The amended permit also required the city to fund a restoration project and to evaluate the feasibility of subsurface intake and potable reuse options. Item 9 is a presentation primarily by the city on the results of the subsurface intake and potable reuse feasibility analysis. And I'll pass it over to Dr. Peter von Langen of our staff now.
I don't have much more to add besides we gave a status update back in January, and here to present the subsurface intake and potable reuse alternative studies are the City of Santa Barbara. We have the Director of Public Works, Rebecca Bjork, and Joshua Hogmark, the Water Resources Manager, who will be presenting their presentations.
Seconds you've been on standby.
Can it be basically the lens adjusted? Because I know it's not my prescription lenses, but the text earlier was a little fuzzy.
Difficult to see. That's the best I can get it right now.
Okay. All right.
Nice picture.
Mr. Chair, board members, my name is Joshua Hagmark. I'm the Water Resources Manager for the City of Santa Barbara. and here today to walk you through two pretty comprehensive studies that the city completed. With me today, I have Tom Secord and Eric Cherisea from Corolla, who will be talking more of the technical sections. To preface it, there is a lot of research and work that we did that goes behind this, and this is just a quick overview to give you an idea of the context. Before I get started, what I wanted to talk about, though, was the process in which we underwent with this. We really strive to have a very open and transparent process, and I think it's been a great model for future water discussions as we continue to have that interaction with the community. But we sought and got the NWRI, the National Water Research Institute, to assist us. They helped us in putting together a technical advisory panel, and they also helped with making available all of our public meetings were all video recorded and put online. Not to mention, we had all of our draft documents were posted prior to the meeting so the community, anybody could download them. And then all public comments were tracked, and all responses to those public comments by the technical advisory panel and by staff were all compiled and put onto to this website that we developed for this. So it was a very interactive process. We thought it was a very good model moving forward for future water discussions. So as part of our discussion today, we'll be given just a little bit of background and the objectives of the study, and then we'll dive right into the study and then ultimate summaries. So how this all started in September of 2014, in the midst, probably the worst part of the drought, we were faced with the decision, do we move forward? We have desal listed as part of our water shortage contingency plan, was to reactivate our desal plant, and City Council at that meeting directed staff to move forward with preparation to reactivate the facility. As part of that, the City Council directed staff and conditioned us to go ahead and also look at subsurface and the option of potable reuse in the future. So that was, they understood that there was a lot on the plate, but they wanted to make sure that that was done. That was later incorporated in 2015 when we came in for our amendment to our NPDES permit, and the regional board made that a condition of our amendment, and that language was added in there along with the timeline. The scope identifies what we're intending to do here is identify feasible alternatives. We were not looking to identify the best alternative. So as part of that timeline, we had two major milestones. One was to complete a work plan by the end of August of 2015, and the other one was to complete and present findings by end of June 2017. And so this chair just shows the public meetings that we've had. We've been actively pursuing this, and in fact we just wrapped up all of our final comments in February of 2017, so it's taken us every bit of this window to get this done and to report here today. The work plan was absolutely fundamental and critical to this, and as soon as we got moving on this, it was quite a bit of work putting that together and circulating it to the public for comments. It was had our public meeting in August of 2015. We had comments from the technical advisory panel. It was ultimately submitted at the end of August to the regional board staff and subsequently approved in October of 2015. The work plan includes the analysis of the maximum yield that is technically feasible from the various options that we looked at. So we wanted to make sure and include everything in there, so we got a good spectrum. In the yield, it didn't matter if the yield met the full replacement needs of the facility, which is the 10,000 acre feet a year. The information is really critical to inform future studies, and you're going to hear that again. And this is actually the website where all this information is housed right now. We have found this to be really helpful and gotten good feedback from the public about it. So the way that the work plan laid out kind of the criteria is we had project options were listed as infeasible, potentially feasible, but did not meet the study goals, and then potentially feasible, and we continue further analysis of those. So the point of this, one of the criterias of the work plan was to identify the project capacity. And so it is to replace the city's existing screened open ocean intake. And right now the facility is permitted for 10,000 acre feet a year, which ends up being about 16,000 gallons per minute. And this includes the assumptions that 45% of the RO recovery and the volume of raw water needed for pretreatment and backwash. At this time, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Secord.
Tom Secord with Corolla Engineers. So Joshua started laying out the project capacity requirement. But as he said before, even if the technologies that we evaluated couldn't meet this overall capacity of just shy of 16,000 gallons per minute, we were identifying the maximum yield that was possible from each technology. So looking at these subsurface intake technologies to feed the desal plant, the city's desalination plant, we looked at six different options, and these spanned the types of subsurface intake technologies that are being used in other places. Based extensive review of state of technology and other recent studies that were conducted by others that had been even evaluated by other regional boards in California for desalination projects. As we approached this study, we looked at various site alternatives, and these would include East Beach, West Beach, and Ledbetter Beach. Let's see. So we focused on properties that were within city-owned lands, so the city actually owns lands within a half mile off the shore of these beaches. So that was the, and these beaches are also proximate to the location of the city's existing intake pipeline. Thought being that we could tie in the water supply from any subsurface intakes along these beaches into the existing intake pipeline feeding back to the desalination. So conceptual designs were developed for these alternatives. Again, we're seeking to base the design on the greatest production capacity if they were unable to meet the 10,000 acre feet per year permitted production required. We were limited by the amount of land that we have available, 9,000 feet, total feet of beachfront on these various sites. And we were seeking to avoid property condemnation. And again, reusing the existing intake pipeline. This graph shows us the flow of water that can be achieved from each of the various intake technologies. On the y-axis there, that's flow. The green line going across the top is that just shy of 16,000 gallon per minute goal. X-axis, we're looking at the different types of intake technologies, and we can see that there are only two options, the subsurface infiltration galleries and the horizontal directionally drilled wells over on the far right side that were able to meet the production goal. Of the other options, we see kind of a mix of blue and orange on these bars, and what that's showing is that some of these intake technologies were going to influence local shallow groundwater. Whereas the two over on the far right, the subsurface infiltration gallery and the directionally drilled wells, were not. And that's important as far as controlling the quality of water and also mobilizing groundwater contamination in the area. So just jumping forward to the end here of our subsurface intake screening, none of the alternatives passed the initial screening criteria. All of the well options and the onshore infiltration galleries were going to impact sensitive habitats, which is also a consequence of drawing in shallow groundwater. And there were design and construction restraints, primarily the amount of beachfront that was available. However, the subsurface infiltration gallery was also constrained by seismic and oceanographic factors, meaning that there were fault lines that had to be crossed for this technology to be implemented. The horizontally directionally drilled well technology passed all of the initial screening criteria except for prior precedent. There were no California or US experiences with this technology. There is roughly about 10 years of global experience, however, the performance is inconsistent. And this was testified to in a Coastal Commission hearing in the lead up to the Carlsbad and Huntington Beach projects. So the not feasible conclusion was supported by the National Water Research Institute Technical Advisory Panel that was assembled by our team, but also this technical advisory panel that supported the Coastal Commission for the proposed Huntington Beach desalination facility. The global experience that everybody seems to point to with this type of technology is in Spain. San Pedro del Pinatar is the name of the plant. And this type of subsurface intake, it experienced capacity loss and poor water quality over time, which makes, I mean, to spend public money on a technology when you might not get the capacity of water you need over time, it makes it very difficult to invest in something like this when you don't have prior experience, prior precedent with the technology. When this plant was expanded, they expanded using a screened open ocean intake technology. We did look at a conceptual design of what this would look like. The red fan over off of East Beach there is what this technology would look like if it were implemented. These 11 fingers that are coming out of a rectangular box there are horizontally directionally drilled lines that would be under the seabed to drain seawater through the sediments back to that box where it would be pumped back to the yellow line, which is the city's existing intake pipeline. That would avoid needing to directionally drill again underneath the railroad, which would probably take about 2 years and a lot of effort to get that line, a new line underneath the railroad. So in conclusion, the subsurface feasibility study recommends monitoring the horizontally directionally drilled technology. It is being tested by others here in California. San Diego County Water Authority is going to pilot test a subsurface intake with constructed in this manner for their Camp Pendleton project. So the city will follow that the progress of that study closely as the city moves forward with their future planning efforts. Next, I'll turn it over to my colleague, we'll talk about the Pueblo Reese study.
Eric Chiracia with Corolla. All right, so as Tom mentioned, I'm gonna go over the Pueblo Reese study that we can
conducted. This potable reuse study considers non-potable reuse, or NPR, indirect potable reuse, IPR, and direct potable reuse, DPR. We wanted to note that regulations and terminologies for all potable reuse continue to evolve, so we just wanted to highlight that note. Again, as with the subsurface intake study, the target production capacity was specified in the work plan. The yield was based on the city's permitted desalination plant capacity of 10,000 acre feet a year. Additionally, the city currently produces approximately 1,400 acre feet a year of non-potable reuse water. So the potable reuse alternatives couldn't impact this NPR production capacity. So overall, the basis of design for this study, the combined potable reuse and non-potable reuse production capacity, was the sum and was 11,400 acre feet a year. To determine how much water was available for potable reuse, we conducted a thorough flow characterization of the city's El Estero wastewater treatment plant, where we considered annual, daily, and hourly flows. One of the major questions up front to answer in the study was how much feed water was available. This graph here shows the result of a capacity analysis. On the y-axis, you have total effluent flow in MGD, million gallons per day, and then it's a percent not exceeded graph of the daily flows. So ultimately for this study, we used the average daily flow of about 7 3/4 million gallons a day, or 8,600 acre feet a year. So this was the amount of water that could be available for any of the potable reuse options. Non-potable reuse, as I mentioned previously, is currently practiced by the city. It's used secondary effluent, which is treated with microfiltration and then chlorinated for disinfection. For this study, it was assumed that the NPR facilities would be relocated to the annex yard and would be incorporated into a new IPR, DPR, advanced water treatment facility. This would free up space at the El Estero wastewater treatment plant site and would also consolidate the treatment equipment and operations expertise. The indirect potable reuse process is dictated by Title 22 requirements. Here's a process flow diagram showing a typical configuration of IPR and what was considered in our study. Secondary effluent from the wastewater treatment plant is equalized and then goes through microfiltration, reverse osmosis, and then UVAOP disinfection. The direct potable reuse treatment train process was based on the most recent regulatory activity and other precedents in California. The major difference between the IPR and the DPR train is there's an additional disinfection step that we've added up front. And the treatment system would have additional process monitoring and control for any response of any process upsets that could be seen. That's shown right there, the additional disinfection step. The advanced water treatment facility was required for any IPR or DPR facility. It requires about 2.5 acres of land to accommodate the equalization tanks and the engineered storage buffer, and then all of the process equipment. The proximity to the El Estero wastewater treatment plant is critical for piping, brine disposal, and industrial operation. This is a model that we showed for conceptual design of the advanced water treatment facility on the city's annex yard property. You'll note the equalization tanks, you have your electrical facilities, and then microfiltration racks, RO, UV, AOP is here, and then any chemicals are located here. So as part of the study, we compiled various alternatives. We ended up with 6 alternatives using different combinations of IPR, DPR, and non-potable reuse. I just, for the purpose of this presentation, I just want to kind of talk through one to illustrate how we talked through all of them. Again, I urge everyone to go look at the study, which is available at the website, for any more details on these alternatives. So for each alternative, we split up the flow that was determined from the flow analysis from El Estero, and then you could split through non-potable reuse, DPR, and in other cases IPR. And then each alternative shows where the water would go, and then a summary of each alternative. So again, cutting to the end of the study, this table presents a summary of the potential maximum yields that were determined for each of the six alternatives. You'll note it's split up between non-potable reuse, indirect potable reuse, and DPR, direct potable reuse. The total yield shown in the far right column and ranges between approximately 7,000 to 7,200 acre feet a year. As with the subsurface intake, conceptual designs were conducted and performed for each of the alternatives. Here's one for alternative 1A, which shows the pipeline alignment, the advanced water treatment facility, and then considers how to get the water for the various alternative, reusing any pipelines, and then in this alternative, going to the lower reservoir and ultimately to be retreated at the Cater Water Treatment Plant. Results of the study showed that none of the potable reuse alternatives met study goals and survived the initial screening analysis. Indirect potable reuse alternatives did not meet the capacity or additional study criteria. So regardless of how much water you could produce, irrelevant of what you could get from Elastero, the wastewater plant, the groundwater basin had insufficient storage capacity to provide the 10,000 acre feet a year. The DPR alternatives passed all initial screening criteria except for one, adequate capacity. And this was based on the limited availability of the effluent from the Elastero wastewater treatment plant. And overall, the alternatives were unable to produce the 10,000 acre feet a year goal of the study. Additionally, no regulations for direct potable reuse exist in the state of California. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Joshua, who's going to conclude and talk about some remarks about regulations.
So, the city of Santa Barbara submitted a letter when the state was working on pursuing direct potable reuse. Certainly, we sent a letter encouraging these regulations to move along faster. And unfortunately, they stuck to their timeline and didn't finish until late December. But they did get it done, and they did show that it was feasible to create direct potable reuse guidelines or regulations. So they are moving forward right now, as you probably are fully aware of, and we'll be watching this. We're eager to see a schedule put to these creation of these regulations. And one of the interesting parts that I thought was helpful out of it is getting away from the terminology direct and indirect. I don't feel like that really helps us at this point, because we're not talking about treating wastewater and putting it directly into the distribution system. In our case, we're talking about surface water augmentation. And for us, our surface water supply is unfortunately small, so it's not considered an indirect. But I think that terminology change will help continue the discussion. And what we're doing right now is we're working on a coalition with three other agencies, the City of Ventura, San Francisco Public Utility Commission, and LADWP, to start to put together, here's how we would do potable reuse. And our goal here is to not only inform the public, here's how we're doing it, but to influence the board and their regulations. So when they do come out with regulations, they will speak to what we believe to be real solutions in the future. They happen to also be using NWRI to try and make this process very transparent and open to the public. And they're also partnering with the Water Environment and Reuse Foundation. So in summary, we find this information is really gonna be invaluable in our long-term planning. We've got a lot of changes coming up for the city. Obviously, a new drought of record. It isn't over yet for us. For us, the drought is over when Kachuma spills, and we're basically, our reservoir is back where it was in 2014 when things were getting bad. So We've got a long ways to go, we believe, before we're out of this drought. And when it does end, that we'll be taking that information and using that to develop our next long-term water supply plan. Also, we are waiting on some pretty significant environmental decisions related to Kachuma, which could significantly decrease the amount of water that's available in Kachuma. Also with that, there's a big discussion about what this safe yield of Kachuma is. There's and we expect that to have impacts as well. And then of course, we have new usage patterns for our community. Right now we've been asking for extraordinary conservation, and I just asked before I left, and or even though we've dialed back our conservation to only 30%, which is what we're asking the community, they hit 40%. So our community is continuing to get the conservation message, and when this drought is over, I do believe there will be a new paradigm for our community as to what our new annual demands are. There's just been a change in behavior with that. But all of these are going to influence then what exactly we need from potable reuse or from desal, and that's why this information will play into those studies. And we expect when we start our long-term water plan, it'll be a 18 to 24 month public process where we're seeking input. So that concludes our presentation, and we're available to answer your questions.
All right, and I do have one speaker card, and perhaps having one speaker card would be good to, you know, have that. If Ms. Redmond would come, and then after that, you know, we can engage in conversation based on the input of all parties. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, members of the board. I'm Kira Redmond from Santa Barbara Channel Keeper. Now that the drought is officially over and surface water supplies have been significantly replenished, that raises numerous questions about Santa Barbara's decision to proceed with reactivating its mothball desalination plant, as well as the process by which agency approvals and permits were obtained to do so. The end of the drought also makes the city's potable reuse and subsurface intake feasibility studies even more relevant and valuable. Unfortunately, as you've heard me say before, the studies were intentionally designed to ensure findings that these environmentally superior alternatives are not feasible, by defining feasible as capable of producing 10,000 acre feet per year. This was done despite the fact that the city is recommissioning the desal plant to produce less than one-third that amount of water, and despite the knowledge that the city doesn't even generate enough wastewater effluent to produce 10,000 acre feet of potable, recycled potable water. Regardless of the fact that this board effectively exempted Santa Barbara from having to comply with the 2015 desal ocean plan amendment, the subsurface intake feasibility study should have followed the guidance in that policy, which states that a design capacity in excess of demonstrated need shall not be used to find subsurface intakes infeasible. Those who have taken time to review the feasibility studies come away with the opposite answer, that both subsurface intakes and potable reuse are in fact feasible and capable of producing at least twice as much water as the 3125 acre feet per year the city intends to produce with desal using the environmentally harmful open ocean intakes. Now that the drought emergency has abated and there is no longer any need to make desperate decisions in panic mode, we sincerely hope that the city will go back and give subsurface intakes and potable reuse a much harder and fairer look. Given the extremely high cost and significant environmental impacts of desal with open ocean intakes, it makes sense to pursue alternatives, especially now. Potable reuse in particular makes a whole lot of sense and is the wave of the future in the opinion of many. Recycled water is a highly reliable, local, drought-proof source of water supply that also reduces the environmental and public health impacts associated with discharging treated wastewater into the ocean. Orange County has been doing indirect potable reuse for nearly a decade, and Los Angeles, San Diego, and other water purveyors are wisely investing in potable reuse. And as you know, the state has prioritized the development of regulations to allow direct potable reuse. This is the direction Santa Barbara should be going as well, and Channel Keeper will continue to advocate for that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So we do not have any additional speaker cards, so I'd like to give my fellow board members, if you have questions, Mayor Delgado.
Yeah, a quick question about the HDD. That was the one that was feasible, but without precedent. And so it was jettisoned because it was without precedent. So my question is, why was it even analyzed when it was known ahead of time that it had no precedent? Wasn't it, yeah.
It had been included in other studies for other projects. So so as to avoid the appearance that we weren't going to consider it because it had been included in those other studies, we included it. The conclusions that we made were supported by the conclusions of those prior studies as well. So.
Okay. And I agreed with Kira when we heard this last time, and I still do. But can you remind me why it was essential to have the 10,000 acre foot requirement if it's not your intent to go to that maximum capacity?
So we've gone around on this several times, and our technical advisory panel had the same question. As I listed, we have a lot of threats to our surface water supplies going forward, and if we very well could find ourselves in the absence of 40% of our surface water supplies that we currently have, which would put us in a position where our 3125 facility is inadequate to meet our needs, and we'll be looking for additional capacities. And so for that reason, we need to preserve what we have as a permitted capacity, because it very well could be needed in the future if some of these environmental regulations come down requiring release of surface waters to reestablish steelhead trout.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So, one of our question that ties a little bit to Mayor Delgado's question, and maybe it was there and I blinked an eye and I didn't see it, but when you had all these different decision tree of feasibility threshold, you know, where, for instance, if I use technology A, will it work or not? Did you have any indicators of at what point you would have been able to have a feasible amount available, meaning, okay, 10,000 no go, 9,000 no go, 6,000 yes, that type of answer for each of the option categories that you evaluated. Did you have that slide, or maybe I didn't see it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the bar chart that
Can we put that back on the screen so I can...
No, it's the bar chart of keep going backwards.
For subsurface?
Yeah, so subsurface. So here, what this graph is showing us is what each of those intake technologies could produce in terms of their maximum yield. And so with the ones that didn't meet the green line across the top, which is the flow required to meet the 10,000, we identified what could be produced, a range of what could be produced. With that, while that is a maximum, they're like the blue, so the impact to the inland groundwater supplies, there is some impact to some sensitive habitat areas, mobilizing groundwater contamination potential. If those flows were pursued, we would need to conduct some additional study, hydrological study, to really, I guess, tone in the exact number that we could expect while trying to control that mobilization of contamination and the impact to the sensitive habitat areas.
Okay, so agreed, not a single option reach the desirable target of 15,900 probably 898 gallons per minute. But the concept of duality of using simultaneously two solutions, I see the onshore infiltration gallery, that gives you 10,000, and then if we add the lower sand slanted well.
I would say really the more comparable comparison would be a combination of one of those intake technologies with the city's existing open ocean intake, or maybe the directionally, if since the subsurface infiltration gallery, the second one in, would have to cross a fault line, the horizontally directionally drilled option, if it could be done successfully, it would be a mix and match of one of the ones that didn't meet the mark with either the open ocean intake or that directionally drilled technology. And the city can consider something like that as they move forward with their long-term water supply plan. The information that was developed is useful toward those sorts of thoughts.
But basically, you know, a hybrid approach would still make this feasible.
It would, but we would have to then offset some of these groundwater impacts.
Sure.
And one of the areas too is the lagoon, Mission Lagoon. Some of these concepts would actually drain the lagoon, and so balancing those. But certainly the concept of being able to do multiple is there.
Yeah.
And that's in your conclusion of the report.
That it could be used to support this sort of future thought, yes. One of the stated conclusions in the report too is we want to follow that directionally drilled technology option and how the San Diego County Water Authority's hopeful successes with that technology are, because we can do everything that we need to with that technology, so
mm-hmm.
we don't have to try and mix and match.
Okay. Then my other question was on the beach choices that you had, and the beach choices that you had were beaches areas owned by the city, and but were there other beaches that perhaps currently are not owned by the city, but yet could have been from a geological standpoint more suitable?
As we went through the work plan development, we identified these particular beaches because of their proximity to the intake pipeline. Certainly outside of this area, there may be opportunities, but they're not in proximity to the infrastructure that is needed to get the water back to the city's desal plant.
And when you say proximity, what's the distance?
So, Mr. Chair, just an example, Ledbetter Beach. After Ledbetter Beach, you basically get a beach that just has cliffs. So you have, there isn't much of a beach to work on and or put any piping in. And then if you go past East Beach, you start to actually leave the city and you get into the county and outside of the jurisdiction. So that's kind of, it seemed, when we drew the parameters of this, we kind of stopped at what we thought to be physical barriers that would be, difficult to move past.
And I would add that, as the idea of these beaches and locations were floated in the work plan, we didn't receive any comments on, you need to consider areas outside of this.
Yeah, I was, just looking at it from we're looking at it from, I'll call it a political boundary, city limits, county, but geology doesn't look at it that way. So if within a quarter of a mile further south from East Beach, there was some more desirable area, perhaps that would have been a consideration. I'm just saying trying to explore what
just given the amount of production we were able to get out of groundwater, well, out of the wells, the beach wells, we didn't feel like we really could get much out of further beach. And that, you know, I think in our study we actually show what beach wells are going to look like, and I think just personally you'd have a lot of objections to all these structures being put on the beach. I think that would be a significant hurdle for anybody to get past.
For example, too, I mean, this was just an analysis of technical feasibility. If it had survived the technical feasibility assessment, there would have been a social feasibility assessment. So all of the infrastructure that we're talking about would need to be sited within like the tsunami run-up area. We can engineer a solution to address that sort of inundation. It might not look very attractive, but we can engineer a solution for it. So it is technically feasible to do this. When you get into the social assessment, then what Mr. Hagmark said would need to be considered.
But your existing facility, though, if you had a tsunami, you would get your feet wet, right?
It is within the base flood area. However, all these structures on that site are base flood elevation higher than the tsunami run.
And they take into account also the sea level rise?
I would need to look back and in order to answer that question, but I do believe that for the funding on this project, we had to look, I know that for the funding on this project, we had to look at sea level rise and the projected tsunami run up in order to qualify for the revolving loan fund money. So I would say that we've addressed that. I don't remember exactly what the answer is.
Then my last question was on the groundwater recharge capacity adequacy.
Mm-hmm.
And can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, there was, I'm ready to jump in here, but there was, so we looked at, one of the biggest challenges is we do not have these good permeable areas in our groundwater basin to actually do recharge, and so it have to be with wells that we have to drill. And so then you start talking, each well is about $2 million a pop for each well, and then more importantly, the property to have to do this. And I forget what we've gotten up to, it was in excess of 20 wells that we would have to put in. And again, that didn't even come close to meeting the 10,000 or even what we had in wastewater. And then we'd have to drill a whole well structures to extract it all downstream of it, and I know that was over 12 wells that we'd have to drill to even get the water out. So it created all kinds of problems, and our, you know, the technical advisory panel was pointing out many flaws in some of the options, because you can actually get water when you're trying to inject it coming back up and creating issues under people's homes and other things. So really the best place to do it is like in Orange County, where you have just gravel soil and you can put it out there and let it settle in. That's really the ideal way to deal with, you know.
And your challenge was because you're predominantly all paved.
Well, yes, no, but it's more than that though. Even if the pavement was gone, it's just the geology of the soils that we have. We have these like lenses that don't really allow for, we don't have a lot of gravel and sand where you can get the nice infiltration that I think in some areas that they experience.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you very much for answering all my questions. Any further?
Yeah, a couple more. Nobody else.
Dr. Hunter?
Thank you for the presentation. For the, I see Carollo contributed to the graphics, so appreciate that. And I'm just struggling a little bit because I read all the materials, but I'm still not clear. And Dr. Wolf kind of looked at this aspect of it. So at this stage, it's possible that the city could identify a combination of design that would allow for subsurface, some component to be subsurface, or is that just completely off the list now?
No, I mean, I think theoretically, yes, there is options that we could look at once we know what volume we're actually looking to bring on shore.
Okay. So but you also say that water security would lead you to look at that 10,000 production. So you're not, that part of the city's criteria is not going to change. That's a given. The city wants water security with the investment in the desal facility. They want to know that they can produce up to 10,000 acre feet if they need to. Should we hit that kind of drought again?
Given the threats to our current supplies, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So given that, then what is the likelihood that a combination of this infrastructure would allow for subsurface? And is it because I'm looking at the illustration of these different ones. Okay, and so you said that the beach wells would present amenities that are not consistent with recreational beach usage, views of the beach and the surf and everything like that. So you wouldn't want to see these little structures sitting on the beach, because there would be a lot of them, or just one or two, or there would be a lot of them.
Yeah.
How many do you know? I'm just guessing.
I think there's like 8 for the beach wells, but for the lateral beach wells. But then the singular wells, I think that we put like 20, and that still was only 3,000.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
Yeah, it was the problem. The soil, you just can't get a lot per well. I think it was only 150 gallons per minute per well.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. And then the HDD well structure, the fan subsurface. That again, that one didn't meet criteria because why?
The prior precedence of the technology, it hasn't been
unreliable.
Demonstrated to be reliable.
Okay.
At this point.
Okay.
So.
So. So it's. I mean, I think your discussion here is informative, and I think the information you brought to the board is helpful to us, because we do have other coastal desalination in the future potentially. And so every effort, every study will help inform us and help other communities. I'm hoping to look at what Santa Barbara's doing, and we want to be sure that we're considering every possibility for reducing the open ocean intake that we have now. So in your study, do you provide a comparative, I don't want to ask this, we know pretty much what the impact is of screened open ocean, and we're trying to reduce that impact. Do you know if you go with your is it SIG they're going with? Pretty much the
well,
SIG.
If the HDD technology could be demonstrated, that's the one that would give us all the flow that we need.
Okay, and then the next one is the SIG.
The SIG can, but we have to cross some fault lines to get far enough out.
Okay.
To avoid the sediment transport issues with daylighting the drains. So.
Right, okay. So do you know what the reduction in impact is from what will likely be the design? Do you know what kind of gains you'll make in reducing the impact from what the open ocean, the screened open ocean intake is?
We don't know this, but this would be certainly something we would have to study at that time. But you know, I want to say for the subsurface intake for this facility, I want to say it was about 5 acres of ocean floor is what would have to be dug up.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course a causeway of sorts put out to get out to it to be able to maintain it. And so you'd have to weigh the construction and impacts of that versus the, you know, this, the current status quo.
There, I would say that there hasn't been a site-specific entrainment study.
Mm-hmm.
Using numbers from kind of an average, there was the power industry studies and
mm-hmm.
The studies from Carlsbad and Huntington Beach, those entrainment studies. Just looking at those numbers and applying it to the flows that are associated with the city's project, it's about equivalent to, I want to say, 0.6 halibuts per year was the number, or might have been per day. No, it's per year. So just looking at the impact, using numbers that are not site-specific, which we don't really want to do, but just using average numbers, that's what it would turn into. We can, yeah. A site-specific study would be better to come up with the numbers to make that comparison.
And is that in a future phase of work to get better numbers on that?
Not currently.
Not currently. What would change? What would change? What would need to change for you to take that step?
Hi, I'm Rebecca Bjork. I'm the public works director. We, a number of things would need to change to take that step. You heard Ms. Redmond say that the drought's over. It's unfortunately far from over, and that's the first thing that has to change. We are incredibly stretched on all of our resources, not the least of which is our staff resources. So our staff is just trying to keep up to a day-to-day workload and taking on any additional work at this time is, I think I will start to see attrition that would scare me. But beyond that, I think that it's a great opportunity for us, and I would expect there would be grant funding and research interest in it, and it's certainly something we could look at once we get out of our continued emergency response plan. When we get through all of the emergency response are in a place where we have stable water supplies, intending to relook at our long-term supply plan, and I would expect this is information that we would want in evaluating all our alternatives as we go forward.
And then my last question is, it's probably in here, but right now I'm not remembering. What is the long-term, what's the timeline for getting this, getting through the remaining stages of validating what looks like the direction you're going to go, and for construction and operation, what's the timeline for that?
Well, for the desal plant,
mm-hmm.
We expect it to be operational within the next couple of weeks, potentially even next week. I mean, it's that close. They're currently going through operational testing right now.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah, and yeah, I think I do want to add to the drought thing. This drought is not over, and I think some of the things that's really challenging with the public is they can't see underground, and our groundwater basins are significantly depleted. The city took on a lot of water debt in the state water system, borrowing water from those who had it, and now we have to repay it. And so, even with desal operating, we've been talking to our community, conservation is still absolutely paramount, and we need to continue that.
Right.
It will take us several years, even when this drought does someday end, to dig back out of it. And so, fundamentally, I think that's an important part that we want to continue to get across to the community. I'm speaking still monthly with our council and the public, trying to continue to drive home that message of conservation.
Yeah, well, I think that's true to statewide that we shouldn't take the pressure off, if you will, for coming to these different solutions for security of water supply. Okay, well, thanks.
Just quick thought here. Dr. Hunter was asking about, the site-specific entrainment study, and your colleague, the director, talked about two droughts, the climate drought and staff drought.
Mm-hmm.
But you hired consultants to do some of this work, so I didn't quite see the correlation there.
I wish it were that easy just to hire consultants. Yes, we do, but we are... we're certainly not an agency that just says, oh yeah, go do this and let us know what you find out. We are actively engaged in that because that's, we take full responsibility, we own responsibility of this. And so, yes, we do leverage a lot of consultants, but that doesn't mean that we're not fully engaged in the work product and directing the work.
Okay. Mayor Delgado?
Yes, thank you. The structures on a beach, I'm thinking of a test slant well that was installed in the Monterey Bay area a year and a half ago or so. I think it's about no more the size of a work cubicle than your standard cubicle in an office.
Mm-hmm.
And is that your sense of a slant well above ground facility, or is your sense of something much larger than that, that it would have such public distaste?
Yeah, no. So in the study, we show the conceptual design for each of them. The problem would be the number, but the actual wellhead facility is about that size of a cubicle. Every three or so, you could have a larger facility for like electrical to power the wellhead. But yeah, each one. But the problem was there was 15 to 20 were scattered to even give you about a third to less of the capacity that was needed.
Okay, but it didn't get to the point when you got to that social analysis because the feasibility didn't get you there, right? Okay. And then the assumption, or the criterion that eminent domain was not a possibility, I understand that can be an ugly process, but I've also seen it work where it's not an ugly process. So my question is, why was that a criterion?
One of the points that we were talking for that was basically for the advanced water treatment facility. And so fortunately we do have a parcel that's currently occupied and actually have some information. In fact, I'm going to council next week to ask for their permission to pursue purchasing a property that's come up for sale in the area, and it would also work to fit this facility. And so actively securing space is important, and certainly as much as we can avoid condemnation, we will. But we were able in this particular study to identify a city parcel at the time. It has current use, so that use would have to be relocated. But we were able to accommodate that, so we felt like we could rule out the condemnation for the study.
Okay, thank you. And the same slant well proposal in Monterey Bay area that I mentioned earlier, it's probably 6 miles from the closest point in the service district it intends to serve. And so it's two or three cities away from the service area. Mm-hmm. And so can you repeat for me why outside city limit parcels were not considered?
So it was proximity to the existing infrastructure, which was the intake pipeline and the existing crossing underneath the railroad. The aspect of city-owned land within that area didn't become an issue because we had all of the access we need. The city owns the parks, the beaches that are in this study area. And as it turns out, going further than half a mile offshore, which would be the boundary of city-owned land, was inconsequential because of the fault lines that exist to cross that boundary. So it never became an issue to need to go outside of the city-owned land within this area. We identified the study area in the work plan that was circulated publicly, provided to the technical advisory panel, and we didn't receive any comments on limiting the study to these sites.
Okay. And how far would you need to move the intake to not, let's say if you were going to do the HDD, how far would you have to move that facility to not cross the fault?
The SIG.
Sorry.
Is the one that crosses the fault. The HDD, we can site it in a way so that it doesn't cross the fault. But it wasn't within the realm of where we were looking for this study. So
how far would you have to expand your realm so that the sink would not cross a fault?
We didn't look.
Do you estimate it'd be tens of miles or?
I don't know.
No data.
Okay.
And then back to the HDD, it's without precedent, it's being considered elsewhere in Southern California. Do you know the timeline by which it might be known if that's a viable, operationally functional facility?
Eric, you talked to them last.
Yeah, I got a recent update probably a month ago. It seemed like it was actually supposed to have started breaking ground, you know, about now, but I think the last I'd heard it was more towards August that they'd break ground. But they're, you know, originally the HDD, so one of the problems with the HDD is to get the pipe through, you have to break through the ground, you have to daylight the drill, which can cause some environmental issues on its own, in the ocean floor. So one of the technologies that had been proposed is a technology that you don't have to daylight the drill. And originally, this study was going to look at that process, but funding had been cut, so actually they're just going to do a conventional daylight the drill. And the scope of the study has been reduced, so now they're just kind of looking more at water quality, not so much the environmental impacts or the constructability. So.
But they have capacity in mind as well?
It's just the one, it's just a test, one finger.
Okay, so you think it might be a year or two before they know if that's a viable, if that's a successful singular well?
Yeah, I think they said planned to be a year and a half of the study.
Okay. And then to have a cluster of them successfully functioning, do you think that might take many more years to get to that point if they were to proceed in that direction?
I think so. I think it'd be interesting to see the process that I was mentioning before, where you don't daylight the drill. That's never been done anywhere. So it's just a proposed idea. So I think that constructability process would need to be demonstrated before it was considered.
I think one of the issues too is that in the industry we're seeing more new supplies developed with reuse as opposed to desalination. The reason for that being that you can't predict the schedule and the cost of desalination as well as you can for a potable reuse project. So more new supplies are being developed with reuse as opposed to desalination. So I don't think that we're going to see the type of research and effort put forward on studying these types of drains as opposed to the projects on reuse. That's not to say, too, that the reuse doesn't face its own struggles with being able to predict schedule and cost when you don't have regulations. If there's something that you all could do to help influence the progression on that, the water supply, water industry would appreciate that.
And given the trend toward reuse, does it give you any pause at all to regarding desal work?
It's really an issue of being able to predict schedule and cost. So people are choosing reuse because of the lack of being able to predict how much we're going to spend and when the supply will be available.
And then finally, I just have a brief comment that it's apparent to me that much good work has been done, and I applaud you for that. And I think that there's well-intentioned good work being done by all of you and the team that aren't here today, so thank you for that work. It's also been my impression since I've heard of this project that there's some good work that's not being done. And the site-specific studies are one example, but there are others that we talked about today. And I just have this sense that it's perhaps not been done because there's a conclusion before us today that we wanted to get to, and that some options weren't ambitiously pursued because they didn't fit the conclusion that we wanted to get to. That's my comment.
Thank you. Ms. Gray?
I just had one question. Thank you all for coming up and presenting today. I think there's been a lot of due diligence exercised here. Is there any sort of monitoring that you're going to do of impingement and entrainment issues at all? I know you're not doing a site-specific survey, but is there any sort of
At this point, there isn't any requirement to do that. So the city, as Ms. Bjork said, if there was funding available for collaborating on some research project that could gather that data, it could be taken up in the future. But there's no requirement at this point.
Okay, thanks.
Dr. Buncher?
Yeah, I had a follow-up because I think I didn't ask my question correctly. So the operation that's currently about to launch is the open ocean, screen and open ocean, the existing system. How long will the continued study of the alternatives and the technical advisory kind of process work its way to the point that the city will have an alternative plan, and then our fund, does that also involve a period of time where funding will have to be secured and so forth? So what is the timeline until we see the alternative and the open ocean structure hopefully diminished in some way, that it, that we offset it in some way?
Right, so there is no current plan at this point. I think our next big step is to develop the long-term water supply plan, which will influence how much we need to develop in new supplies, and from there, potentially how we're gonna feed those new supplies. It could be that our next supply is bottle reuse, it could be that our next supply is gonna be more desal, because that's how we're gonna make up for lost surface water supply. So all those need to be factored in, and then the next discussion would be, you know, offsetting those impacts.
And the current production is what?
It's about 3 MGD, 3,000 acre feet a year.
And I don't know that you can answer this question, but I'm gonna ask it anyway. What's your sense of the commitment of the city leaders? What is their view on the importance of reducing impact to the marine environment through entrainment and impingement of the current design? Is there a concern? Is there an acceptance? Do people think that it's perfectly okay to use that system just because you didn't have to meet the new requirements, which we understand California took a lot of resources, a lot of experts, and a lot of time to understand best ways to produce water from desalination and reduce impacts to the marine environment?
Obviously, I can't speak for our city council, but I can speak to that's how our city council has consistently behaved over the last, I'd say, four decades, which is to be a leader in the environmental field. They have had an obligation as well to provide water for the constituents. And to that end, since 1996, they have worked to maintain and keep current the desal permits for the existing desal plant. I think that the improvements that you saw to the desal plant that were not mandated by your board, that were not mandated by the Coastal Commission, to decrease the size of the screen, to commit to do the studies that we are now reporting to you, those were commitments that our council made ahead of anyone asking us to do them. So I think those speak loudly to the commitment of our city council.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I appreciate that view. I am looking forward to hearing progress toward a different design, and that what we're learning from other systems that are going to come online with under the new regulations, that hopefully some of that will, some of the technology and the approach will help to inform the city of Santa Barbara's direction. I mean, you've got fisheries, you've got other economic dimensions of the region to consider, and I think from what we have seen in internationally, how the long-term open ocean intake does affect the marine environment, and will have if this system continues to operate in its current design. So I would hope that your city leaders would take the long look at the point that it makes sense. But in the meantime, it's it's a system that is out of date. It's archaic, and we're hoping that you'll take the steps to move it into a more benign system for the marine environment.
Mr. Johnson?
I don't really have any questions. Thank you for the update. I remember clearly, the decision to put Santa Barbara under the old regulations and the stuff that led up to it, and I think, it was pretty clear going into this study of under seabed alternative intakes that this was something the city had agreed to do, but essentially, I wouldn't call it a throwaway, but potentially was. It was something that the city had agreed to do, but the city had agreed to do it as part of a package of not having to install those intakes. And I think that people approached it really seriously, and I think that it sounds like you had a good public process. It sounds like you really got some useful information that as you go forward and your water needs become clear, the technologies become clearer as you make your decisions going forward, I'm hopeful that the work that you did on this will prove to be useful.
So, well, likewise, I would thank all of you and also the Ms. Redmond from giving us some additional points of view. So, to be continued, but before closing this item, wanted to give an opportunity for staff, if you had any, Peter, you have any parting comment or input? This was your agenda item?
No, I think the city, Peter Von Langen, Center Coast Water Board staff, no, I think the city summarized their studies well, and I don't have anything else to add at this point.
All right, thank you. Mr. Robertson?
I think this kind of exhausts the obligations that we expected of the city right now, in this loop that we've been in for the last year and a half, 2 years on this. So I think for now, we're at an end.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Robertson. So is there any scenario or any change in circumstances in which monitoring would be required of entrainment and pinching?
Peter Velling, Central Coast Water Board staff. It's not required from the city because they are an existing facility. If they were ever to expand it above the 10,000 acre feet a year that they're currently permitted for, then there would be requirements for doing the monitoring for entrainment instrument and also subsurface intake for the monitoring and researching.
All right. So this concludes this item. I'd like to thank all of you for your participation. And Mr. Robertson, should we move to item 10?
Yes, and I think what we'll do is we'll postpone our update from our liaison from State Water Board until tomorrow. Maybe we can take that up as one of our first items tomorrow. But I don't think he's available. Steve's not available for the rest of the day. Okay, so moving on to item 10. Item 10 is our enforcement report in its relatively new format. This enforcement report covers actions taken during the period from December 1st, 2016 through March 31st, 2017, as reflected in tables 1 through 3 in your enforcement report. And this report also covers discharger reported violations for the period from October 1st through December 31st, 2016. Staff is evaluating these violations to determine priority and if enforcement actions will be taken. Also, I want to call your attention to page 2 of the enforcement, page 2 still in table 1 of the enforcement report, to a penalty assessed against the city of Paso Robles for $495,000, consistent with the State Water Board's enforcement policy. We targeted approximately half of this amount toward a yet to be identified project relating to sustainable groundwater management plan development or implementation for the Paso groundwater base. Trying to keep that money local and targeted at high priority things. And then lastly, I would add that Taya Tryon, our enforcement coordinator here in the Central Coast region, is here to answer any questions you might have about the report.
Following up on that, this period for Paso, in which 165 violations occurred, what time frame for that? Oh, December 1 through March 31, so about 15 months?
I'd have to double check, but the when we say that these are the these are the orders that were issued
3 months. Yeah.
During that, that doesn't mean that's when the violations occurred. They occurred much earlier.
Okay, so really.
It takes some time,
yes,
to process them and go through settlement discussions, et cetera. And actually, these ones are probably, I think, about a year old.
So this is, I made a calculation error, 4 months. This table covers 4 months, during which the 165 violations moved through the process and then surfaced to the report.
No, the 4 months represent when the actual final orders were issued.
Okay.
Right, so I actually signed that in that 4 month window, but the violations were accrued a year or more ago, or before that even.
So is there a projection? Is there a problem with their system that they had such a high level?
Yeah, they were transitioning to a different treatment system, enhancing their treatment system.
Okay.
So there's a lot less violations now.
But they're still reporting violations.
Well, it's a pretty large system, so there's always some violations. Can't run it perfectly when you have those large systems.
Mm-hmm. So, but we wouldn't see on the magnitude of hundreds.
You never know.
unlikely. So they're working through the sort of the shakedown of a relatively new plant,
mm-hmm.
and they were trying to perfect disinfection kind of at the back end of the treatment system. And they think they have it under control now. They think they've worked out the way to not get violations and still get the treatment.
And these are monetary penalties, so we don't really have flexibility. Every effluent violation that is identified, we have to assess the $3,000 minimum monetary penalty.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right, very good, thanks.
I do have a question. Mr. Johnson?
So, Paso Robles, do they discharge into the Salinas River? I know they're right by it.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I'm assuming that those 165 violations, that we saw those earlier as notices of violations?
Potentially, this is Taya's new format. In the old format, presented as clearly as they were. They probably came by,
mm-hmm.
but it was that mass data dump that we used to do, if you recall,
right.
The attachment.
Yeah, I remember discussing why there were so many there at the time. So now, just to understand the new format, so now they would show up as recent violations pending staff review without an identification as to the discharger, which is on page 5.
Right, if you look at the last table, the recent violations pending further enforcement staff review, they're also done during a different time period. They're from October 1st, 2016 through December 31st, 2016. And these are all reported into CWICS. So what happens is the discharger reports a violation in CWIX, and then program staff go through, evaluate reports to determine if those violations are accurate or if there are violations that are missing. Once program staff have identified those, they move them forward to the enforcement team to take action on or to take to review them. So what we've done, instead of downloading all that raw data from CWIX
mm-hmm.
that hasn't really been thoroughly vetted by program staff and enforcement staff, what we've done instead now is categorize them into what types of violations they are. Because
mm-hmm.
the other issue is that we can't really talk about pending enforcement actions, and that's kind of what was happening, because the data dump is there, but we haven't really reviewed them yet, so we don't know whether we're going to take enforcement action
right,
or not.
Right, these are often self-reported.
So that's why we've kind of categorized them, because it's not as meaningful yet, because we haven't done that thorough evaluation yet to see if they're even valid violations.
Okay, and if they are, then they'll show up in Table 3, Notices of Violations.
Yeah, so these are all the in Tables 1, 2, and 3, especially 1 and 2 for this report, are actually the administrative civil liability orders. And that it can sometimes be months of negotiation,
right.
evaluation.
But there will typically be a notice of violation before that, right?
Yes.
So they would show up in Table 3 as a notice of violation, and then would either be resolved or dropped on our part if they convinced us, or it would end up in Table 1 or 2.
Right.
Okay.
So the notices of violation is we term it as informal,
mm-hmm.
and it's an information gathering process. So maybe say we learn of a sanitary sewer spill, and we issue a notice of violation saying, hey, we want to know more about this spill. Can you give us the technical details? Or maybe that's not a great example, but notices of violation are kind of like information gathering to help
sure.
us evaluate.
Sunland Garden Products, failure to design sediment basin properly. When we go over it with them, we may actually decide that's not a violation.
Right, or there was misinformation, and or they reported it wrong, and that's just a just gathering more information.
Or after the NOV, they move back into compliance, and we can let go. You know, the ultimate goal here is getting people back into compliance, whether it means all the way through to Table 1 in the ACL, or whether we can resolve it at an NOV level, or even before then.
So we're not here just to mess with the dischargers?
Yeah.
So then the other thing that happens is we can't follow up on every single enforcement potential. We prioritize, and we have to prioritize like any other unit in our office. And so we deal with the ones that are a threat to our quality. We have to deal with MMPs because that's the law. Or we deal with ones that are really affecting the integrity of the program. Maybe they're not hugely water quality impacts. Maybe it's like missing to submit a report, but it affects the integrity of the program. We expect everybody to comply with the permits. So we do a continual prioritization every quarter to see what comes up to the top, what we need to deal with, because there's more than we have. There's more than we
I found the new format, I found it a little less sleep-inducing, a little easier to get an overall picture of what's going on, and to kind of pinpoint things that I really wanted to understand more about. So
right, and I think the summaries just kind of help you understand what was that thing before we just kind of listed them. And this kind of helps you understand what the issue was, like failing to enroll into the permit, that type of thing. And then the penalty amounts and how much is going to fund projects in GAAP.
Right, I think we have one more question from Ms. Gray. No, Mary Delgado. Very brief question, very brief comment. So if a given city fails to submit an annual report, is it an automatic $1,300 fine?
No. We evaluate why and we go through the process in determining if this was an intentional avoidance of submittal. So we go through each case independently, determine, you know, if we should pursue enforcement to get him into compliance. Was it because there was a staff change and they just didn't have someone that was experienced enough to know that it was due on that date? And sometimes we'll work with them, or we go through settlement discussions and we resolve it. It all depends.
So I'm going to say our goal is to get him into compliance. Starting to sound like a broken record here, but and so that might start out with the question, why didn't you submit? You know, and again, we're just trying to nudge him along, and sometimes it's a kick and sometimes it's a gentle nudge into compliance.
Okay. Well, thank you. And my brief comment is that I'm sorry that a certain city marina did not succeed in submitting its annual report.
Yeah, because you really don't want to deal with it anyway.
I was just going to say that actually it depends on which county we're talking about. Monterey County, Tyrannicus, full of Renegades. So actually, I'm going to make that little comment and then let me say, no, say, Bob, you gave me an opening. So a question that I have for Mr. Robertson is with Paso Robles, you know, we provided them in lieu of a fine, you know, the availability to use funding for a study. When that agreement was drafted, was there a timetable and some, you know, good constraints? Because I want to make sure when we have ACLs and we agree on certain things that the system doesn't get abused.
Yeah, with respect to making a determination, so I'm going to speak from a fragile memory, I'll call it.
You'll be totally forgiven.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. As I recall, I think we talked about putting in a two-year, I'm looking around for Michael because we talked about this, a two-year timeline to understand exactly and articulate what that project was going to be, and then outside that timeline we would consider revisiting at mutual request, and the default is this money heads towards down the amount that was identified for a Sigma plan implementation or model development would revert to GAAP in the absence of a specified project in a two-year time window. And we left the option open that we could extend that too if we determined that was appropriate to extend. Like if we're close to a decision, it makes sense to extend the time allowance.
Okay.
That answer your question?
Yeah. Question, because you know, I think, you know, with penalties and then when we do provide, you know, an incentive for local projects, you know, that has to be done in good faith in the part of the, you know, the folks who basically receive the fine. And you know, one example is you know, water treatment plant, and looking at grants to fully fund a purple pipe extension, and also was looking at funding to perform the analysis of how much for water would be sold. And basically what came out is with the hope to sell the water at a 10% reduced rate from potable water. And you know, I look at that, and just like everybody else in this room, we're all, you know, taxpayers. It's using taxpayers' money to monetize projects, and that doesn't quite pass my sanity check.
I would also add, and certainly there were in years past problems with supplemental environmental projects either not being appropriately tracked or not meeting appropriate goals. In 2009, the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement promulgated a set policy, which, you know, I'm sure when you're working through, it has specific findings as to financial accountability, nexus to water quality violations that need to be met. And I'm sure you worked with Jessica and
oh, yeah.
The OE attorneys to make sure that
we've gone through midnight
yeah.
programs with those, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, the you can set up a SEP, right? You set the fine, but ultimately when you have a settlement and they say, okay, you know what, we're going to carve out $250,000 and you can use for XYZ project, that's the part that becomes a little more brittle. You know, the SEP is pretty well defined, you know, it's formula driven, etc., and everybody makes a conscientious effort of going through the calculation and the agony of what is fair and equitable. But I just want to make sure, and this is not for this project specific, but you know, you're enforcement, so you know, we got to make sure that when we sign agreements, that we really prevent what I call the wiggle room of someone abusing the system.
Right, and we've had some offline conversations about this, of how we, you know, we learn, okay, now we're wiser, we tighten up the program again. So, yeah.
Thank you. So, no further questions. So, Thea, thank you very much, appreciate it. So we have two choices, Mr. Robertson. We go right through the next item, or we take a break. What's your pleasure?
Well, I'll leave that to the board. Break.
Break.
I've
just been overruled by the vice chair. Break, and we'll let's reconvene. But we may need a good time here about 4 o'clock.